Our last speaker is Alan Carlson, who holds a PhD in modern European history from Ohio University. He was long associated with the Rockford Institute and is founder and president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society. He's an author and lecturer, and his most recent book, which I can happily display for you, is The New Agrarian Mind. Came out from Transaction last year. Thank you very much. I keep being told by the conference organizers that I am supposed to end on a happy, upbeat note. Alas, I am both genetically Swedish and spiritually Lutheran. I can't do upbeat. So I will aim instead at quiet contentment. One theme for this weekend's meeting has been to consider the legacy of the agrarians. As my modest contribution, I want to examine how the agrarian movements of the 1930s, Northern as well as Southern, fared when they faced the same question in their day that has been posed to me this day: can Leviathan be tamed? The economic political goal of the agrarians and of their Chestertonian distributist allies was creation of the property state, one built on the widest possible diffusion of ownership of productive property, starting with land. Their vision was of a robust countryside composed of small subsistence farms with happy farmers, that's John Crow Ransom's phrase, jovial and fertile wives, and plenty of rosy-cheeked children. One distributist writer described this ideal way of life this way: a comfortable home in which to labor and play, with trees and grass and flowers and skies and stars, a vegetable garden, fruit trees, some fowls, some goats and a cow, some bees, and three big dogs to keep the salesmen out. And I, at least, have time for love, for children, for a few friends, and for the work I like to do. Villages and small towns would dot the countryside as well, where local shops would craft the necessary machine-made goods for local consumption, and merchants would provide, oh, those few things, such as coffee, that the farms could not supply themselves. Modest cities would be centers of regional identity, where the poets and writers and musicians growing out of their folk culture would gather to celebrate their special place on earth, to publish and to perform. The enemy of the agrarian vision in the 1930s, the Leviathan that they feared, was not the centralizing state per se. Broadly, the enemy was industrialism, the spread of industrial organization and its premises, the quest for efficiency, a highly refined division of labor, the constant substitution of labor for capital into every corner of life. More specifically, their enemy was what they labeled finance capital. Herbert Agar defined it as a barbarism based on monopoly, a system of commercial buccaneers who built their wealth by plundering the people. These were hard words. Notably, the agrarians argued that this economic result was not the consequence of natural historic change. Rather, they saw the giant joint stock corporations of the early 20th century as the consequence of a grant by the state of legal privileges, privileges denied to families and individuals. These included the concept of limited liability, perpetual life, protecting the corporation from the hazards of death and inheritance taxes to which family enterprises were subject, and the ability to issue stocks, bonds, and debt instruments, which gave the large corporations a huge advantage in raising capital. They saw large corporations as tools of economic centralization. They leveled small shops, family businesses, local producers, and regional diversity. And this, in turn, made the process of political centralization a cakewalk. The Northern agrarian, Ralph Borsodi, called articles of incorporation, quote, veritable letters of marque, granting corporate leaders immunity from their criminal acts. He continued, the charter which the state grants to the organizer of a corporation is a commission to embark upon the adventure of doing the investing public with impunity. Again, hard words. But of course, such charges carried a certain force in the early 1930s. The abandoned hulks of the many great factories and the unemployed millions standing in relief lines seemed to testify to the false promises of finance capital. And this was seen in turn as the consequence of an incestuous relationship between big money and the state. But this left the agrarians with a terrible problem. The work of finance capital had already been done. The 48 states had issued thousands of corporate charters over the last century. Vast numbers of farmers had lost their land to banks, insurance companies, and large corporations. Many people were still on the land. The farm population of 1935 was still larger than it had been in 1900, numbering about 30 million people. But tenants now outnumbered owners. How could the regime of small property be restored? For some, the reluctant answer was to turn to Leviathan itself, to the central state, and use it now to undo the damage done earlier. Phrased another way, the necessary task was to employ the central state to rebuild a traditional order already corrupted by the earlier projects of the various states. Indeed, this is how we might see some aspects of the New Deal of the 1930s as an attempt at traditionalist reconstruction through federal agency. Most modern conservatives, of course, scoff at the very idea. The federal government can never get anything right, except it seems in national security affairs. The New Deal, so the regular interpretation goes, was radical, socialist, a failure, opinions backed by a fair amount of evidence. But a more charitable reading of the New Deal experience suggests that the agrarians may have made some progress during the 1930s in their admittedly difficult task. For example, the Subsistence Homestead Program, initially part of the National Industrial Recovery Act, was a remarkable experiment in rural renewal, and one partly inspired by the Southern Agrarian Manifesto, I'll Take My Stand. Between 1934 and 1940, about 200 federal homestead projects took form in all corners of the country. New homes set on 4 to 10 acre plots, large family gardens, chicken coops, and family cows were the common features of these places. Photos of smiling, rosy-cheeked children resettled from urban or rural slums in these lovely garden homes and fields filled the government reports. Beyond this propaganda, it appears that some of the projects really did work, such as Granger homesteads in Iowa, informally guided by the agrarian Catholic priest Luigi Ligudi. Or consider the tobacco allotment program also instituted in the New Deal years. To this day, the contemporary agrarian writer Wendell Berry insists that this strategy of production control, quote, has worked well. In my part of the country, it has ensured the survival of thousands of small farmers for more than half a century. But the agrarian project rested on another, usually implicit requirement. Rebuilding a decentralist order in America, one resting on a healthy regionalism, and one requiring time to work out meant that America must turn inward. Foreign adventures and foreign wars must be avoided, for they would fuel and guide Leviathan in the wrong way and threaten those gains that had already been achieved. Herbert Agar caught the spirit of this need in his 1935 book, Land of the Free. Quote, "It is our job to save a corner of the world from the despotisms that encroach on Europe. The best traits in American life were not those copied from the old continent, but the traits we have freely adopted or else originated, the traits which are our own. Were regional cultures in America, the South, the Middle West, the Far West, were signs of a new affirmation of life, world cities such as Chicago and New York were corrupted by cosmopolitanism and stricken with sterility." Indeed, as the war spread over Europe, or as war spread over Europe in 1939, many of the agrarians logically sympathized with the America First campaign, holding that the USA should stay out of the conflict. As Father Legutti, newly appointed executive secretary of the National Catholic Rural Life Conference, explained in early 1941, "If we are to maintain the American way, we must continue and develop the works for social and economic reconstruction within our beloved land, and we must not go out in battle array to save periodically our democracy." But global war was unpredictable. The Leviathans of Central Europe and the Asian coast had their own intentions, and America wound up in their way. It was the fall of France and the Battle of Britain in 1940 that led Herbert Agar to abandon his earlier arguments and to favor American entry into the war. At first, he tried to cast Britain's struggle as a kind of agrarian conflict. The British were fighting, quote, "for a chance for decent men and women to live their lives without cruelty. They want to be left alone to tend their gardens." Where England was deindustrializing, he argued, Germany represented total industrialism on the march. But other agrarians still remained deeply distrustful of Leviathan at war. The ever-faithful Donald Davidson warned in early 1941 that American entry into the war could only result in, quote, "a highly industrialized, centralized, and socialistic order." Responding to Agar's call for intervention, Davidson continued, "I should have thought agrarians and decentralists would oppose our entry into the conflict when such, no matter what results might be achieved in Europe, would probably be ruinous to their hopes for a healthy reconstruction in America." But less than a year later came Pearl Harbor, which in the space of an hour closed off all debate. Agrarian reconstruction would be shelved. Leviathan must be unleashed for total war. Some writers who had gathered around the journal Free America tried to find decentralist straws in the new gale of centralization. Lewis Mumford, for example, argued that wartime social planning, quote, "must establish every new industry, every new highway, every new housing development in new decentralized suburbs." Another writer wanted to, quote, "decentralize the war effort now by spreading federal agencies around the country and writing war propaganda on a region-specific basis." As in, I suppose, buy bonds, y'all. Sorry about that. Springfield Barr wanted to create a world republic, arguing that decentralists and agrarians ought most surely to be in the ranks of those who have discovered the TNT concealed in national sovereignty. Alas, these arguments actually testified to the frailty of the term decentralism as a meaningful intellectual construct, and to the shutting down of the real agrarian project. In a wonderful book entitled Kinship with the Land, Regionalist Thought in Iowa, 1894 to 1942, the late E. Bradford Burns describes the end of regionalism, agrarianism, and of a distinctive folk culture in one Midwestern state. After December 1941, he wrote, one national goal exacted the full attention of everyone, to defeat the Axis power in Europe and Asia. The war scattered the sons and daughters of Iowa to faraway places. All Iowans lifted their sights to global horizons, and they thus far have found it difficult to focus internally again. The more thoughtful agrarians simply retreated from the political stage. Their fear of the domestic consequence of war had no prospects for a hearing after December 7th. In the great push for victory, American farms would be quickly mechanized and consolidated. Talk of subsistence homesteads and horse-drawn plows suddenly seemed to be sentimental foolishness. Between 1941 and 1945, a full quarter of the American farm population would flow into military service or defense work in the cities. Most would never return. The great emptying of the American countryside had begun. Finance capitalists, the so-called plutocrats of the 1930s, were transformed almost overnight into widely admired captains of industry, the efficient mobilizers of America's productive might, the architects of victory. Some of the agrarians, notably Agar, and a little later John Crow Ransom, would repudiate their agrarian work. Others simply drifted away to other concerns in life. But a few, such as Andrew Lytle, Donald Davidson, Frank Owsley, and Father Lagouti, tended the small agrarian flame, turning toward more literary or scholarly projects, or to a focus on reconstructing life after the war. Sometimes I suspect the agrarian flame became very private, residing only in their hearts. Leviathan had been loosed in all its power to fight a global war, to eliminate the great evils of that time. It must have its day. The remaining agrarians would wait for a later day, after the fury had passed, when some imaginations might once again be inspired by the vision of a well-settled countryside full of happy, rosy-cheeked children.